Welcome back, dear listeners, to the Dish with Dina podcast. I am so happy to have you join us again. This week, my guest is Dr. Arunima Bera. Dr. Bera and I dish about our personal and professional experiences around nutrition and the limitations of nutrition education between physicians and their patients. Dr. Bera is a pediatric ICU physician located in California who was gracious enough to present at one of my past virtual wellness retreats where she discussed preventing and managing burnout. Her Instagram page is chock full of insights and musings about the wellness world, especially regarding inequities in medical care and education and advocacy in dismantling barriers and the vilification of cultural foods. I am so honored to call Dr. Bera a colleague and a friend. So sit back, enjoy the conversation, and let's dish. Welcome, Dr. Arunima Bera, to the Dish with Dina podcast. Thank you so much for joining me so early in the morning on your side of the country. How are you today?
I am so well, thank you. Thanks, Dina, for having me. And I am so excited for a conversation around food and nutrition and our culture and all of that. So yeah, love to get into it.
Me too. I'm excited too. As I always start off my episodes, my interviews, I should say, I like taking a trip down memory lane in our personal ways of how we came across each other. And as a lot of my guests have come to my life through the magic that is social media, our story starts there too. Do you remember like how far back? Because I think it was a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe at least a year and something.
Yeah. I think it was sometime in 2021, which is wild that we're like almost at the end of 2022. And yeah, you know, I came across your page and I found it not only informative, but also incredibly transparent in terms of nutrition and how layered it is, and even education of, you know, the nutritional sciences. And then we connected, and then I, you know, got the opportunity to participate and give a talk at your retreat, the Made with Love wellness retreat, which was amazing. And, you know, just got to connect with so many other people too. So yeah, that's how our friendship online began.
It is. I've said this before and I'll say it again. I have no problem with stalking people on the internet, especially when I'm just in love with who they are and the mission and message. And I think in your case too, and of course you'll talk a little bit more about your career and your life, but I also found you very open, transparent, not afraid to say a lot of things, which, you know, on social media sometimes can attract negative feedback. And I feel like I really felt so grateful to you that you were saying things that needed to be said and that you were not afraid to voice your opinion. And that you have the knowledge and the feedback, I should say, you have the knowledge and the experience that I look to somebody who is qualified for making some of these statements online, where, you know, when we're looking at the world of social media, it could be a little sketchy as to who we're listening to, who's influencing our population. And I'm also so grateful that you were a part of that retreat because, well, for the listeners, this was for 2 years in a row, we did a mental health fundraiser. Right. In December. I'm sad to announce at the time of this recording, I'm not going to do it this year because I have way too much going on, but I will pick it up again next year and reach out to the same people that presented last time and maybe some new people in the mix too. Because you're right. It's so fun and enlightening and so many diverse backgrounds and people that come in, but we all share a common love of just, you know, wellness and wanting to support each other in both physical and mental capacities. So let's take a trip further on your end of things down memory lane and share with us some of your background, your cultural upbringing, some of your earliest food memories, and we'll eventually get to the point of how that maybe influenced you positively or negatively as you went through your own life cycles.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really love this question because I feel like I've never really been asked this in terms of how my upbringing has been connected to food and food memory is also such an interesting phrase, right? So, you know, in terms of my upbringing, I was born and raised in India for the first 10 years of my life. Culturally, because India is just such an incredibly diverse country with so many subcultures and regions with its own, you know, distinct food and, you know, customs and everything. I was raised on the West Coast. So I grew up in Mumbai, but culturally, I'm from the East Coast of India. So I'm Bengali. And food is a direct extension and expression of our love and hospitality and just the way for us to connect with one another. So I think there, in and of itself, tells you a lot about how I relate with food, and how my family does too. And yeah, so that's really how that really was our philosophy, and it still is, of growing up with food, where we always saw a cause for, whenever there was a cause for celebration for anything, food would always be at the center of it. And I would say that, I grew up in India for the first decade of my life, and then I moved to the Middle East and grew up in Qatar for the second decade of my life. That's where FIFA is happening, in just a few weeks for now. For those who don't know where Qatar is, it's gonna be on the map everywhere very soon. But yeah, that's essentially where I grew up as a child and then a teenager before moving to the States as a student, as a medical student. I would say that, in terms of the habits that I had, or that even my family had in India, we were, in equal parts vegetarian and non-vegetarian. So we were sort of true omnivores in that sense, where, a lot of our meals would actually be what we call plant-based. So they didn't have any meat. We would definitely have, like, chicken and fish and meat maybe like 2 or 3 days of the week, but it was never really a predominant part of eating. And that definitely changed when we moved to the Middle East, because in the Middle East there is just such a predominance of, first of all, also larger meals, because there also it's very much a communal culture and people come together for food. But there is also a very big sort of presence of just meat-related dishes and stuff like that. And so that's the influence of the place, right? An influence of people who've grown up there that then kind of shape up your own eating habits. So yeah, that's kind of, it moved from one place to the other.
Absolutely, with the assimilation of things. I wanted to just recognize, first of all, at the time of this recording, it is Diwali. So happy Diwali to you.
Oh, thank
For those who
you.
don't know, since you were speaking about celebrations, can you share a little bit about what the celebration of Diwali is and what kind of foods would you see when you are taking place? Because it's not just a day, it's a while, it's a length of time.
Yes, so Diwali is a pretty big festival in India, although it also depends which region of India you're from, because there is variability in terms of how and if people even celebrate it. In pretty simple, maybe oversimplified terms, Diwali is really the celebration of light over darkness. And people who follow Hinduism, Jainism, Sikhism, these different religions around the world, and others also, but predominantly these religions, will celebrate it throughout the world by really lighting the symbols of light. So lighting candles, lighting diyas, that's like the traditional term that we use for, our candles, and really lighting up the community with a lot of fireworks, with sparklers to celebrate the triumph of, goodness over evil. And in terms of food, because it is a pretty big festival, we have a lot of sweets. I actually bought a whole box of sweets yesterday because, it just goes without saying. And a lot of, like, rich, indulgent food usually follows, not just Diwali, but a lot of other festivals too. We actually had a pretty long 10-day festival called Durga Puja if you're a Bengali, or Navratri if you're from the western part of India. That festival is actually something that my family personally, we celebrate a lot more. And that is also something, it goes by, as in it's celebrated for the triumph of Goddess Durga, who's this very, you know, big symbol of feminine power in our religion and in our culture, and it's her triumph over evil. So yeah, that's basically the crux of it. And you know, if you're back home, it's really like the equivalent of Christmas back home in terms of every street, every house being lit up, and it's so beautiful.
I have had some sweets. One of my dear friends is Indian, but I cannot remember what region she's from. And we up here in New York City, for anybody who's familiar with Queens, Jackson Heights is a very big Indian neighborhood, and there's community marketplaces that cater specifically to that population. So you do find authentic ingredients. The Patel Brothers is one of the places that people go shopping for all of their loose foods and bulk items. And she took me on a tour once for, it was at the time I was working on a school project about cultural markets and, you know, trying to see what is out here in the world of New York City and just taste the flavors of things. And the sweets of India are, the ones that we had were very rich and sweet. They were condensed milk is, I think, used in a lot of the ones that I had, and I wasn't used to such sweet treats. And it was very rich. I had like one and I was like, I'm done. This is all I need.
No, absolutely. They are extremely rich. Like you clocked it, there's a lot of sugar, condensed milk. There's a lot of ghee, right? So the vegetable fats and even just other types of oil. So yeah, you do have to be a little careful of, you know, enjoying it in some moderation. But yeah, that's just the beauty of it.
That is fantastic. So I want to talk a little bit about the role of love and hospitality that plays in foods, especially like you were saying, this is the way that we share, right? We want to involve other people. We invite people over to take place in our house, in our home, and this is how we welcome them. In my family, that was it too. But what I recognize in growing up is that food really did equal love. And so if we ended up, as we were getting older, you know, realizing like, that's a lot of food to put on someone's plate. No, thank you. I'm kind of done. And I need to push myself away from the table, because we did have what was known as the clean plate club. I think we talked about this before, you and I, but that is like offensive to my mother and my grandmother. And so did you also experience that too, where emotions take place? It's not just the nourishment factor of I'm here to nourish the physical being, but I'm also here to share with you an extension of my heart. And then to kind of say, you know, I'm full, I don't want any, or I'm following a certain diet and this really doesn't work within my meal plan. You know, how do you kind of end up telling people like, listen, it's not you, it's me. So yeah. Did you also experience some of that too growing up?
Right. Absolutely. And I'll paint some, you know, scenes for you that will exactly demonstrate how sometimes, you know, I think everyone's intention is in the right place, right? They just have so much love for you, especially when, you know, because we were growing up in Qatar. So when we would go back home in India, people are seeing us after a year or sometimes years, right? So they just want to like offer all the love and affection that they have for you through food sometimes. But unfortunately, and this did take me some time to realize, you know, as an adult, is that sometimes like not being able to draw boundaries for yourself and in a respectful way, you know, kind of, really draw a boundary, or knowing when to say no when you're being offered too much. That is something that I feel like collectively we as a culture need to just like learn how to be a little bit better at. So, you know, there would be times when, say if we would be visiting India, visiting our relatives, sometimes we would visit like two or three homes in a row, right? And they may not know that, but for them, you know, we're coming, they have a whole like buffet like laid out. And sometimes they will be watching you like a hawk eating. And as soon as you're done with your plate, they will encourage you slash, you know, really make you take like seconds, right? And there was one time when I got sick. I was just 13 and I just didn't know to say no, or didn't even know when I was done. But, you know, my body felt it. And by the time I reached the third home, I got really sick and that was not a great experience. So That's definitely a big thing too in our culture, where not only people offer a lot of food as an expression of their love, but they also take it personally if you either don't want to take all of it or don't take seconds. And while again the intention is in the right place, I do think that there needs to be an acknowledgement that different people have different limits. We just have our natural limits of how much we can eat. We have our preferences. And, that has got nothing to do with, your offering. And, I will love you just as much, and appreciate you, even if I'm not able to finish my plate. And finishing my, that clean plate club or finishing your plate, that also was really an evolution for me, because I think growing up, I think my parents did a really good job of keeping it very balanced in terms of they would expect me to eat, say, all of my vegetables. I was kind of conditioned not to be a picky eater because I didn't really have much of a choice. But at the same time, my mom always maintained that you don't need to treat your stomach as a garbage bin and just stuff it and stuff it and stuff it, because that's not serving you well in any way. So that was also something that, I realized growing up.
Yeah, I agree with that too. It's like if I say, oh, no, thank you, and the recipient, the person who spent so much time and put so much love into their food and cooking and preparing things for us, they would either say, well, actually, they would say, oh, you don't like it. But what they were really trying to say is, you don't love me. Right? That's how I started thinking of it. And so, like you said, it became of like a courtesy, like, oh no, I'll have some because I want to avoid this awkward conversation that makes you think that I'm personally attacking you if I don't want to have one more scoop of something that you've created, especially on a day that I've already ventured to, six other houses or whatever, especially during the holidays where we're going from place to place. And yeah, those buffets and those spreads are no joke, my friends. So walk us through now, as you are starting to be more independent, even coming to the US as well. Like, what are some of the things that you started picking up on where you were responsible, or were you responsible for the food shopping, for the food cooking, and the ways that maybe things differed when you were starting to realize this culture is not the same, and depending on what way you want to explain that, as what you knew from your other areas of living?
So, when I moved as a medical student, I actually came to New York as well, because I went to Cornell for medical school. So I was on the Upper East Side. And as a medical student living on the Upper East Side, it was tough because it's literally the one of the most expensive parts of Manhattan. And so, even before that, I'd just like to point out that because I had come to Ithaca on a research scholarship for a couple months, and that was sort of my first trip solo as a student with other groups of students. And there was this sort of the only form of culture shock, because everything else, we had been exposed to a lot of American culture, music, movies, and things like that. But my first bit of culture shock, which to this day I'm still shocked every now and then, is just the portion sizes of food and how just big everything was for one individual. And Ithaca, is a relatively rural part. It's like upstate New York, right? Or it, going into Western New York, and the rate of obesity there is relatively high. And again, just visually, that was sort of my first thing that I, just registered, where I was like, wow, like these portion sizes are big, big. And so when I moved as a medical student, I really had to figure out how to gather, how to shop in grocery stores that wouldn't completely like bankrupt me, because a lot of stores on the Upper East Side, at least at the time, I'm talking about like 7, 8 years ago, they were mostly like gourmet markets. There were very few like bodega stores. There wasn't really like a Target or a Trader Joe's or really anything, unless I'd have to take like the 4 or the 6 downtown local train. But that still took me like a couple weeks to figure out. So, just like affordability and accessibility to just fresh produce and groceries as a medical student was a little tough. in the beginning. And so when I discovered places like Trader Joe's, what was nice was that there were meals that were more affordable, and there were meals that were easier to prepare for someone who was busy, right? So with our schedules, with the kind of hours that we worked. And so that was actually a perfect fit for me, because I got to do that. Now, in terms of being able to continue with my cultural food, or the food that, you know, we would eat at home, that kind of took a process, because I'll be very honest, I wish I cooked more, and I wished I learned more from my mom. Like, growing up, I think I was really sheltered that way. But that was something that I kind of had to start, you know, doing myself. And I'm so glad that living alone as an adult sort of, you know, forced me to go through that journey myself. And it's so much fun. Even to this day, I'm like discovering new recipes and stuff like that. But it did take some time to adjust to just being completely self-reliant.
And I think that brings up for me in the food accessibility discussion, because sometimes you can have locally, you're physically able to access food, but it is so out of your price range, or it's not something that complies with some of the things that you're used to having. So why spend so much money on things that you might not use, or that you're going to have to find new ways of doing things? And I love what you mentioned too about the convenience factors. You know, I try to tell people too, if you don't love cooking, or you don't have time cooking, or you can't cook, you know, there are other options available to you that could still be healthy and still be affordable. You just have to sometimes get a little creative. Or in the case of my world, I purposely budget out grocery things that are more convenient, heat and eat type of things, and delivery services on weeks where I cannot get to someplace. I mean, I would love, and I used to love cooking everything from scratch, and I just can't do it anymore. So it's okay for anyone listening. You know, this is the thing that I often feel hits my heart when I watch people struggle with trying to like do whatever is considered the ideal recommended way of doing things. But the point is, it's just recommendations. It's just guidelines. You still have to meet everybody where they're at, because not everybody can conform or comply with a certain set of standards. And then of course, we also have some obstacles and barriers thrown in our way, whether it's accessibility or inequity, or, you know, whatever it is that people, not everybody is going to have the same access to the same things. And so I want to bring that in then now towards more your current state of affairs here, if you don't mind. How has that journey of understanding nutrition, understanding that works for you, you know, the buying, the shopping, etc., you mentioned that helped you become a better physician in educating your parents, in educating your patients. Yeah. And we also have this conversation of interprofessional team support. So, you know, we're all hoping to support the patient in a variety of different ways, but we also know our scope of practice might be limited in certain things. So can you share with me a little bit about your actual academic studies, how that played a role with food and nutrition guidance, but then your own personal journey, how that might have also played a role too?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. So I will say that knowing what I know now, applying the things, and even, you know, learning on a daily basis, you know, from people like you, from the experts on nutrition, that has made such a profound impact in the way that I guide my own patients. I do think that in medical school, and even in our medical training after that, the nutritional side of management a lot of times gets a little bit oversimplified, and there just isn't much of either an emphasis or a scope for, you know, really getting into the incredible range of nutritional needs, not just needs, but also the backgrounds of our patients. And also, I think even like the basic understanding of health and how like nutrition may impact your health. So I do think that there is really a big room for incorporating more of, you know, nutritional science and awareness into our medical education. And, you know, while we may not have, because, you know, the reality is the kind of healthcare systems that we all work in, we do have huge time constraints in terms of how much time we're able to spend with each patient. So, you know, I'm not saying that like we have to do a whole hour long, like it's just not within our scope to do that with every patient. But even having the awareness of the different types of nutrition, the different nutritional needs, and what the latest evidence and research, you know, says, just having that awareness will allow us to be a lot more informed and to also give advice that isn't just like blanket statements to our patients, because that is really not useful to our patients. So, you know, for me, honestly, the personal journey of how nutrition became such an important part of my own life was really during fellowship. So I did my fellowship in pediatric critical care. That's after I completed my residency in general pediatrics, because I wanted to study, you know, in the ICU. I wanted to learn how to manage really critically ill patients. And while, you know, doing the training was great in that it, I think it made me so much more of a competent physician. The hours were crazy. You know, the hours were intense, all kinds of hours during the day and night. You know, we were doing day shifts, night shifts, 24-hour shifts sometimes, very poor sleep, stress levels were through the roof. I mean, if you survey literally any fellow, they will probably tell you the same. And that started impacting my health, you know, in a very real way. You know, to tell you a little bit about my personal medical history, I've had PCOS for a few years, and you know that was managed, you know, relatively well with my medications. But I noticed, especially in my first year of fellowship, that I was gaining weight, and you know, I was having low energy and just overall, you know, not feeling that great. And on one of my preventive screening labs, I found that my HbA1c, which is a marker of diabetes and prediabetes, it was high. It was pretty close to being in the pre-diabetic range. And just knowing everything about diabetes, seeing patients, including pediatric patients with diabetes, that was something that was such a wake-up call for me, in that I just went to myself that, oh, I cannot let my health spiral out of control just because of, you know, my job and my training, you know? And so I really had to make my health, my nutrition especially, a big priority. And that really sort of kickstarted my journey towards personal nutrition. I joined a, you know, at the time it was an in-person gym group where they also had a nutritionist on board. And I got to know, you know, why do we bother about macros? What is the role of carbs and protein and fat in your diet? How do you know portion things out? So I would say that has made such a big impact on my own life that now I feel like I'm able to take those lessons and apply them, you know, with my patients.
So much of what you're saying is bringing up other topics that are related. So what I want to start with first is, I believe we've had some other guests as well. We've talked about PCOS, so polycystic ovary syndrome, hormonal relations, and the fact that it does mimic sometimes, because it's there's an insulin resistance thing there too. So it does mimic sometimes type 2 diabetes. So people might be put on things like metformin, which is to help with that insulin resistance. And so the thing that I want to point out about this, because I know Nima, you and I have talked about this as well, that when we hear the term of diabetes or anything that might be affecting insulin or blood sugar levels, as you mentioned with the blood test there, immediately it feels like the first line of intervention is always cut carbs out of your diet completely. And when you talk about things like this to people who did grow up having carbs and starchy foods, and you know, we have this discussion of like vilifying cultural food ways, it's then that becomes not just the stress factor of managing a chronic condition, but now completely removing the identity of who you are. So taking that into account too, you know, cultural humility, cultural sensitivity, being in the world of interdisciplinary discussions with your own patients as well, how do you kind of reconcile that too? Because it's hard for people just to completely remove something out. And of course, I think you might agree. I'm not for that. I'm more about, let's see how we can modify some things without making you feel like you've lost your culture. So how do you approach that for yourself with managing your own condition? And then also some of the things that you might recommend to whomever you also speak to in your medical world?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So first of all, elimination of any one food group just in general is not a good recommendation. I mean, we all need carbs for basic survival, right? Even a patient with diabetes or PCOS or any form of insulin resistance, you may need to, you know, lower them slightly or switch from simple to complex carbohydrates, right? With lower glycemic indices, but you absolutely need carbs to survive and to sustain. And I'm so glad you've, you know, brought up this whole idea of like moralizing certain foods and how a lot of people still sort of vilify cultural foods. I mean, I just find it so interesting that we vilify cultural foods, but then we also appropriate a lot of cultural foods and then lead them to go mainstream and then, you know, inflation and everything. So what I think of it is that you can absolutely strike a balance between taking care of the medical part of, you know, the condition, because at the end of the day, that is very important. That should be a priority. And also maintaining foods that are important to you, that give you a sense of, you know, wholeness, that give you a sense of joy. Food is supposed to give you joy, right? Food is supposed to make you feel happy, make you feel at home. I mean, these are themes that we've already touched upon, and it is absolutely possible to do that even when you have certain restrictions, you know, on you. I don't even really like the word restriction because it automatically feels like I have to deprive myself. So maybe a better word is modification, or a better word is just adaptation, because at the end of the day, this has to be a lifestyle choice, right? So but even when some doctors tell patients that, okay, you have to cut out carbs, how are we going to sustain that lifestyle? If you were to tell me that as a patient, I'd just be like, well, I'll eat just 20 grams of carbs tomorrow, and tomorrow I'm going to rebound back from today and, you know, get into that cycle, right? Which many people do get into a restriction and binge cycle, because that is just not a good place to start as it is. So that's how, you know, I have sort of tried to follow, you know, advice for myself. And that's how I always tell my patients too, that we, you know, there is absolutely the space where you can strike a balance between the two. And also knowing that you do not have to cut off your cultural food. So, you know, things like, okay, if, first of all, even because, you know, rice came to mind, right, since we're talking about carbs, and there is white rice, there's brown rice, there's so many different types of rice, and there's this sort of common advice that, oh, brown rice is like the golden example compared to white rice, but actually, if you look at the numbers, there's not that much of a difference. And in more situations than others, if you just be mindful of the amount that you're eating, then, you know, as long as you're not overdoing it with either group, you'll be fine. Because rice is such a big part of so many different cultures, you know, not just South Asian cultures. So, yeah, that's a really sort of key example of how you don't need to cut that out. Even quinoa. Quinoa is a great example of carb that has fiber. It makes you feel full for a lot longer, and it's complex. So, you know, you can absolutely, you know, incorporate these things without having to vilify them.
To give up your culture. And you're right. That comes to mind as well with the first thing I hear from so many of my patients who get referred to me from their doctors, or if they are a lot of times when we're on campus, because I'm also the campus nutritionist, they might also be doing athletic things. And so their coaches are saying no more rice. And the population on our campus is very diverse. You have people from Guyana, Ghana, Taiwan, Korea, like every, I mean, it's a staple food. Rice is a staple food. Number one. Number two, That's offensive if you try to tell me to switch out brown rice when I have white rice. Like, there are just certain meals that it's just not going to make any sense. It's the taste, the texture, ugh, I would never do that. Number three, when I teach global foods as well, one of my classes and undergrad courses is called Foods, Society, and Health. And we take literally a, you know, trip, well, I mean, not literally, a figurative trip around the world. And we look at everybody's food pyramids and they all look exactly the same. So to implement this Eurocentric approach with the Mediterranean diet being the end all be all, when some people don't have access to fish or they don't want certain tastes and things. And yet also when you compare the Mediterranean diet with the foods, again, the, you know, the typical recommended foods in all of these other cultures, it's the exact same thing, the exact same thing. So I really, I think this is a good opportunity for us in this discussion, for anyone listening, to have patient advocacy, to for you who are listening, to not just listen to your doctor or healthcare provider tell you you can't eat rice anymore, to question those things or to ask, you know, well, then what is the guidance that you would give? Because there's no way I'm giving that up. And just like what started this discussion, it's not just about nourishment. This is how we connect in social gatherings. You know, this is now all of a sudden I'm not going to be able to go to my family's house during the holidays because they're eating things that are off my avoid list. Like, just know, I love the words that you used as well, you know, like different kind, instead of restriction of things, just modification, and, you know, not having to remove anything, because you do end up with that binging taking place. Because when you forego, especially food groups that you don't know how to then replace. So, you know, for an example, if somebody's telling you use brown rice instead of white rice, I wouldn't say that. I would say keep your white rice, maybe be moderate with your portions, and add some more fibrous foods like lentils or legumes or something like that to add the fibrous factor to it. And now you have the equal amount of calories that your body needs without restriction, and you can still enjoy your rice dish.
Yes.
That's my go-to. One of the other things I had written down too is about taking people's experiences and external factors into account, because again, you know, slapping on a one size fits all or a meal plan of some kind, or just pointing to the government's recommendations of things, doesn't take into account the experience. And so, much like you were saying, in the medical field, you don't necessarily learn a lot about nutrition. In the nutrition field, we don't normally learn a lot about mental health and the factors that play in the role of like behavioral things, of understanding that people, especially women in this country, have been chronic dieters since the age of 9, and or have had body image issues, or were told, you know, from external parties in their family or other people of why they do or do not look a certain way. And it's hard for a dietitian to know how to implement some sort of discussion with that when we don't really have a lot of experience in there. So for anyone listening to, you know, if you are a dietitian or you are playing a role in a medical health, medical field in some way, healthcare provider field, this is a good opportunity to extend a referral out as well to, for somebody to see a social worker or a therapist, because I am not able to do a lot with that scope that I have. I can do, you know, I can interview people, I can get them to kind of come up with their own goals. But if there are challenges there that I'm not able to help them move past, they have to deal with trauma in a different way.
Yeah. I'm so glad you mentioned this. Sorry, I didn't mean
yeah,
to interrupt.
But please.
The connection between the mind and the gut is so strong. And again, it is something that I feel like we, as when we are in the early stages of our medical training, it really needs to be cemented. And, you know, you're right, like there, food is also, there's so much of emotions, you know, attached with them. And if you are going through something that is stressful, if you're having, you know, anxiety or depression, it can have, you know, a tremendous effect on your appetite, on, you know, just your like digestive health in general. So while, you know, you as the nutritional expert and I as a physician can take care of sort of the somatic parts of it, the mental part of it, and that's why it's a, you know, interdisciplinary, you know, effort for the patient. And and absolutely, like mental health is really at the forefront of all of that as well.
Yeah. This is why people say things like, I had a gut feeling. That's the connection. You literally have a bi-directional communication called the vagus nerve, for any nerds out there. And it is bi-directional. So if I'm dealing with stress in my head, or I feel like confused about something, it can affect my digestion. If my gut is dealing with, you know, GI discomfort, or I'm feeling bloated all the time, or something is inflamed in some way, that can cause brain fog and other things. So it's really important to support all of that. And I love that discussion too, by the way, of like gut health and how the bugs outweigh the rest of your body as far as cells are concerned. Like they have their own population down there.
Right.
Nima, will you walk us through kind of like a week in the life of you right now? What are some of the things that you are doing as far as career, personal pursuits? How do you manage your own health these days?
Yeah, absolutely. So my life for the past 2 years, you know, I am very grateful and excited to work in a underserved area. So I work in a medically underserved area in the Central Valley of California. And so my life actually every week can be a little bit different, because when I'm working, then, you know, I'm on for 24 hours actually. I'm working 24/7 at my hospital versus when I'm off. So it's about a, you know, week on, week off schedule. And so my nutrition and the way that, you know, my day can go can be a little bit different based on, you know, what week I'm on. I do try my best to meal prep a little bit, you know, in advance when I am working, because just because of the awareness that you know, when I'm busy, I'm not going to want to cook something from scratch for lunch or for dinner. And, you know, if I do get food from takeout, I just give myself that little bit of permission that, you know, it is okay to order, you know, out maybe a little bit more frequently than I would when I'm off. But, you know, when I do order food from outside places, I still try to be very mindful of the types of things that I, you know, order. So it's usually some form of grilled protein with, you know, rice and veggies, so that it's as balanced as possible. And then of course there's also like hospital food that I'll sometimes get to. But yeah, so that's usually my, you know, schedule when I'm working. The one constant though, that again, not, it's become a part of my life and it feels very weird if I don't do it, is working out. It is the way that I it's almost like meditative on some days when my brain is just too buzzed with things to do, and I can just take an hour and move my body and feel more grounded. It's a way for me to connect with my community. You know, we have a little fitness community and that's wonderful. And then of course it's a way to move my body. You know, movement is also an extension of medicine, and there are so many things that you can potentially prevent by just moving your body. And that's not just, you know, things like metabolic syndrome, like heart disease, high cholesterol, diabetes, etc., but it's also your joint health, it's your brain health, you know, it's just overall the health of your body. So I try to incorporate strength training, a combination of strength and cardio training, at least 3 to 4 times a week. And on the days when I don't train with my group, I will try to do a walk. And the weather is a lot nicer now to be able to walk outside. So I'll try to get some form of movement per day. And I definitely continue that when I'm off as well.
Yeah. These are what are known as the non-negotiables. Like, you know that you've determined something in your life that helps you keep grounded, reduces stress, is also helping protect and prevent things like bone disease, muscle loss. You know, the future you is benefiting from that, as is the current you. And that's something that I think, even with your busy schedule, you're a true testament that things can fit if you're planning and preparing and accommodating some things in certain ways. Because when you say I'm working for 24 hours, I'm like, well, I mean, do you get to go to the bathroom? Do you stop for a meal? You can, right? Like, you can, you just don't have a lot of luxury of time and things, but you still have like breaks and things that you can take during the day where you can stop and eat. And
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is, yeah, I say 24 hours because the phone is on for the
right
whole time.
That's the shift.
But I do have some downtime in between my patients, especially, you know, during the afternoon and evenings. And honestly, it's all about mindset, right? So it used to be a little bit, You know, I used to be a little bit nervous in the beginning because I would always be like, well, what if I get called in when I'm working out, or what if something happens? And then this is something actually that a colleague of mine had told me when I was working as a fellow, that you can take 10 minutes out of your time to eat a meal, or you can even take 35 to 40 minutes out of your time to work out. You know, it will be okay. And, you know, if you need to go, you will go. But your life takes a priority too. And that is just such an important thing, you know, for you to be told, and then for you to like realize that for yourself. Because in the field of healthcare in general, you know, not just medicine, sometimes it can feel very self-sacrificial. And that's actually how I felt when I started seeing some parts of my health, you know, taking a bit of a downturn, where I was like, just because I'm working, I don't want, you know, my health to suffer. And getting into nutrition, getting into, you know, working out was really how I took that control back. And I felt so empowered for myself. And so if I could just, you know, give that message to other people, it's that you deserve to have a very healthy life, you know, despite all the other pressures that you may feel on you from society. Like you deserve to take care of yourself. That self-care is not just a this pampering, luxurious thing, that it is your right, you know. And yeah, anyway.
Yes, I love that because, like you said, especially for those of us in the health and wellness areas, sometimes we do not lead and live by example. And you mentioned boundaries earlier too. There's something about boundaries with our own selves as well, of setting a timer and saying, that's it, I'm done for the day. Or at the end of every, you know, hour and a half, I'm going to step aside and just go get something to eat or drink, or put my eyes in a different direction that is not facing a screen, or, you know, all of these things, because it's an investment. You know, we're so quick to, with the convenience factors, we want immediate gratification, everything quick, as fast as possible. And we also want to see results quickly too. But we don't often think of longevity. And that is really important too. Like, you're investing in the health of who you are now, but also who you will be in the future, that you can bounce back from things and maybe be less prone or less at risk for diseases to happen in your later years, which hopefully everybody wants that. So Nima, before we start wrapping up, is there anything that I have a question, but I'm going to wait to see if you bring it up first. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you would like to share with our listeners?
Actually, you know, when you just mentioned longevity, that made me really think about just the idea of like losing X number of pounds in X number of time. I really would like to sort of let go of this. I mean, a lot of it is marketing, a lot of it is branding, but I would like to let go of that. You know, I mean, in my own, you know, relatively short period of taking fitness seriously, I have lost up to 15 pounds. I have gained 5 to 10 pounds. I mean, it's really been this cycle, but my labs have been a lot better. My HbA1c, again, the marker of prediabetes, has been rock solid. So the point that I'm trying to make is that first of all, the number on your scale does not really mean much when the other parts of your health are not being accounted for, right? And that number is a product of so many variables. So for us to not really fixate on that, because at the end of the day, health can really look like so many different things, right? A conventionally skinny or thin person can still have a lot of health problems, and you know, a person that may be overweight and obese, you know, may be even healthier than the other person. So to really take to account that going to your preventive health screenings, getting your labs checked, you know, checking with to see if you have any other risk factors because of family history, those things, and then of course taking care of your mind and taking care of your body, those things are far, far more important than, you know, just your size or your weight. And I it's kind of unfortunate that our society is still, I'm so glad that body positivity, just also visually, so many types of bodies have come to the forefront because of the internet. I'm so glad for that. But because I didn't really have much of that growing up, right, in my childhood. But I still feel like our society really needs to move the needle away from being so look-centric, and you know, all of that language around fat shaming and things like that. So I just wanted to mention that too.
No, I'm glad you did, because a lot of people that I am engaged with and the new generation of dietitians as well, we are really trying to fight against categorizing people just on the BMI and focusing on health as well, and really taking away that stigma of fat phobia. And the, you know, it, listen, anybody who's listening, it's not your fault, right? Like, we have marketing. I was joking one time that I feel like even a car commercial at the end has a disclaimer, like, might cause you to lose weight, because like that's a benefit that everybody seems to tag on to everything. And it's like, what if I don't want to lose weight? Or what if I can't lose weight, but I want to still be healthy? Like, what are we really focusing on? Like you said, is it the size and shape of my body, or is it the fact that I'm living a healthy life, both physically and mentally? So I love that message, that take home. My question had to do more with your love of singing and dancing, because I know on your Instagram, you share some of that. Will you tell us a little bit about that? Are you formally trained? Is this a hobby that you did? Tell us a little bit of how that started, and then we'll wind down and I'll share with you my last final questions.
I love singing and dancing. It's still it's a very, very big part of my culture, you know, growing up as a Bengali child. My parents take, you know, I would like to give them a lot of credit, not only for taking me to music classes. So I am formally trained in Indian classical music since I was 5 years old. But they would also sing a lot of lullabies to me and just sing a lot in general. And they say that, oh, that's how you know, got a musical sense since you were young. So a lot of credit for them, credit to them for that. But yeah, I've been singing since I could speak, and it is also now growing up, you know, as we all live a little bit further away from our families, especially for me, it's a way for me to stay connected, stay grounded with my culture, stay connected with my family. And dancing is something that brings me so much joy. It's so fun. It's my favorite form of cardio. I will pick dancing over running any given day. So yeah, absolutely love doing the two. And yeah, I love now actually I really love recording covers in different languages that may not be my own, because that's how I love connecting with other languages. So I've started picking up more songs in Spanish. I love you know, just the language of Spanish and also how the words flow in different songs. So I'm definitely working on my pronunciation, because I'm a bit of a perfectionist when it comes to that. But but yeah, I just absolutely love doing it. It's part of who I
I
am.
love it too. I think that also speaks to creative outlets, right? So we have in the world of health and wellness, we have, you know, food, nutrition, sleep, physical activity, and self-care as well. As you mentioned, it's not a form of luxury or pampering. It's something that you are doing and engaging in some way. And then also an extension of creativity in some way, whether it's playing games or dancing or doing something that just gets your other side of the brain working in some other way. I think that's really something that I know I haven't done in a while. Like, I've really missed, I used to color. I love taking coloring books and crayons and just getting in the zone of staying within or outside of the lines or whatever. And that was my way of kind of doing something creative. And I miss that. And I know I have coloring books and crayons in my apartment, so that might be something I'll start implementing again. Yeah, just to kind of get that going. So Nima, let me ask you then my last two questions, somewhat related. These are, what is on your plate today? And we're talking about both, what are you doing, as in the next thing that you do once we're done wrapping up here, because it is in the beginning part of the week, kind of midday for me, but early morning for you. And then what is on your plate as far as what is the next thing you're actually preparing or eating for yourself?
That's great. So I'm off today. So honestly, the main thing on my plate is to catch up on rest and to clean my house. So yeah, it's a day of rest and, you know, recuperation from a week of work. Rest is very important, and I do find that even in doing chores, it's actually very it's restful, because you're kind of just focusing your mind on like a physical task rather than, you know, what's up in here. So that is on my plate for the day. And what I probably will be eating is, I made some, you know, simple chicken curry yesterday in for Diwali. So I'll probably be having some of those leftovers. The nice thing about a lot of Indian dishes is the food is often even tastier the day after, because all the spices and flavors really get to get into all the protein. So yeah, I'll be having that with a side of white basmati rice, because it's the best.
Yes, props to the side dish, the main player, rice, white rice. I love that. Nima, it has been a pleasure catching up with you, getting to have this conversation focused about food, but also interrelated in some way in the careers that we've both had for ourselves and how that plays a role. And that's really what a lot of what this podcast started out doing was that everybody eats and we all have a story to share. And there's a lot more similarities that I believe that brings us together in the world of food and you know, the way that we have our celebrations and our cultures and our social gatherings than there are differences. And so, especially since we're going on, dare I say, year four of this pandemic at some point, that, you know, I want the listeners to take in that find those little nuggets of things that bring you joy. Know that you are allowed to speak up for yourself and advocate for yourself. Try not to be too hard on yourself when you are not doing what you think is perfect. Strive for progress and enjoyment, and don't worry so much about the things that you should be doing, just the things that you want to be doing. So thank you very much for spending time with me
Absolutely.
today.
Oh, thank you so much. And people like you make me so hopeful that, you know, we are really going to turn around the whole face and the whole approach to wellness and nutrition and mental health. So thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me this week on the Dish with Dina podcast. I am Dina D'Alessandro, registered dietitian, nutritionist, founder, and chief executive life changer at Dish with Dina, and I'm also your host. If you like what you heard, I would be so grateful if you could subscribe to this podcast, leave a review, and share this with others who you think might benefit from what we have to offer on these episodes. You can also join my mailing list at dishwithdina.com or email me at info@dishwithdina.com with questions, comments, feedback, and if you'd like to be a guest on a future episode, because everybody eats and we all have a story to share. I hope you tune back in next week when we dish again.